A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a special edition of the New Statesman podcast, which is entirely themed around Harry Potter. Yes, you might think that we've gone completely mad, but actually we discovered in the office that almost every political, social and economic problem can be explored through the medium of J.K. Rowling's series about the boy wizard, later boring civil servant. I'm going to start off first of all by talking about politics with Stephen Bush, our Staggers editor, and Anna Leskovitz, our editorial assistant. Hello both.
Hello.
Hello.
And we're going to talk about politics first. It's the obvious place for the New Statesman to start. And Anna, I'm going to start with you because during the election campaign, you wrote and unsuccessfully tweeted at J.K. Rowling a question. And it sounds like a very simple question, which is, can wizards vote in Muggle elections? But what are the implications of that?
Well, the issue with wizards being able to vote in Muggle elections is really that there's huge segregation politically between Muggles and wizards, and I feel like the wizards are essentially controlling the Muggle population because they can send their Minister of Magic in to just go and tell the Prime Minister what to do. So essentially in that regard he's a bit pointless, and that might be why wizards have absolutely no interest in voting in Muggle elections.
Because they don't need to participate in the democratic process.
Exactly.
Because they are autocrats. Well, Stephen, that points up a slightly larger problem with Harry Potter. That obviously we know that J.K. Rowling is an impeccable Labour supporter and would never advocate brutal autocratic leaderships. But even the what happens, I mean, Voldemort is obviously supposed to be a kind of, you know, Hitler Stalin style dictator and autocrat and cult leader, but what replaces him is sort of a benign dictator, isn't it? There's no real system of checks and balances in the wizarding world.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple of intriguing questions. I mean, I always assumed they did vote because, yeah, he's a minister of magic, therefore applying, yeah, there's a development minister appointed by the Prime Minister. I'd assumed it was a subsidiary department. But
there's no Prime Minister of magic.
That's because he's the Minister of Magic in the Prime Minister of Britain's government.
Yeah, but the Prime Minister, not the Muggle Prime Minister, doesn't get to appoint him, so that's what I mean. The whole thing is just a fiction, isn't it?
There doesn't seem to be any elections at all. Dumbledore gets offered, in quotation marks, the job of Minister for Magic several times, but turns it down. And you wonder what sort of process allows people at some unnamed body to just say, hey, would you like to be the Minister for Magic?
And is that not the Wizengamot, which is thoroughly unexplored, but seems to be slightly sinister?
Potentially it could be the Wizengamot, though Dumbledore already seems to be on the Wizengamot. So if the Wizengamot can choose their own people to be the Minister for Magic, that seems problematic, especially if they're not elected.
And there doesn't appear to be that much of a welfare state. I mean, obviously, this comes to one big question of Harry Potter, which is why are the Weasleys so poor? Right, so she has a job, I can't remember what it is, but she has some form of job, and he is a senior civil servant. Without wishing to offend any senior civil servants who may listen to the NS podcast, they're minted! I mean, and also the children leave. They have fewer and fewer children who, presumably, if they're really that hard done by, can be sending money back to them. But, you know, their care costs go down and they are still just as skin broke in books.
And normally, if you were a senior civil servant, you'd be complaining all the time about your private school fees. But Hogwarts doesn't appear to have any fees, so far as we know, right?
Yeah,
it's not that Harry's got some sort of special place because he's an orphan.
Well, Harry's got loads of money. Money in the wizarding world seems to travel primarily through inheritance. There does not seem to be any sort of inheritance tax or anything like that.
Wealth generation.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's small businesses and enterprises being started by wizards.
Yeah.
Apart from the Weasley and their joke shop. But that's the point. How do wizards earn money? Because they aren't any wizard wealth creators.
Yeah, I think all the jobs essentially are ministry jobs, which is why I think that people in the ministry don't seem to be particularly well imbursed for their time, and yet the people who are high up in the ministry seem to be the people who've inherited most well.
But the problem is that what we're heading towards, Stephen, is the acknowledgement that possibly Mr. Weasley is like a gambling problem. Or, you know, spends it all at the bookies or something.
That would explain
like
it.
That.
Even, so let's go for the Anna theory, and it's basically a Kremlin-style regime where civil servants are moved to the top with the Minister of Magic sitting atop this awful bureaucracy, and they're not very well paid. They should still become more wealthy as the book goes on, because the children are getting older, they can take...
Bill has gone after tame dragons in wherever. Yeah,
That's Charlie.
Charlie, what does Bill do?
Bill works for a bank, so you'd think he'd have quite a lot of money, but I don't understand how that works. But Bill and Charlie seem to be separate from the family and not giving them any money. Percy, they sever ties with Percy, so there's no money coming in from him. Fred and George are always in the process of setting up the joke shop.
Can Bill and Charlie buy their own houses? I'm sure we'll return to this when we have John Hellage on the podcast later, but...
I worry that this is very much becoming the economy section of our podcast.
I think people will cope somehow, but yeah.
But Bill has Shell Cottage with Fleur.
You know a lot about Harry Potter.
Yeah. Charlie, I mean, he's in Romania. We don't really get a sense of what his setup is like. I assume he can afford a house in Romania.
Ah, but that suggests they are in the Schengen Agreement. Further evidence that they are, in fact, a subsidiary of the UK government. Just saying.
Yeah.
How do they get on planes? Do they have passports?
No, I mean, they can travel by apparition immediately, so there doesn't seem to be
any
border
control. Why would you go to Terminal 2 if you can apparate in France immediately?
And we don't have a philosophy section, so I feel is another interesting question, because an existentialist would say that when you apparate, you die. Yeah, I am the sum of my matter and my physical being. I'm reconstituted when I apparate. Therefore, you know, Stephen One has died, and a second Stephen with identical memories. Yes, yada yada yada.
Isn't that the plot of that Christian Bale film? That's, you know, the one I mean. The one that's got David Bowie as Nikola Tesla.
Oh yeah, the third one with the hats and Hugh Jackman. What's it called?
Yeah, exactly
that one.
That
film, yeah.
Well, if any listeners can prompt Stephen and my memories of a film that we've definitely seen, then that would be very helpful. But yes, I agree with you that there are, I mean, again, we could talk probably all day about, to my mind, the problems with the physical laws. But at the point when you're kind of trying to say, well, hang on, this magic doesn't obey the laws of the universe, you probably need to go and have a quiet to lie down. But okay, let's think of other things that are fundamental to UK politics. So, democratic oversight.
Yeah, I think one of the really interesting things about Harry Potter politics versus our UK politics is that they have different priorities. So while, what would you say our priorities in our political system are, like, democratic freedom, perhaps, is the number one?
Fighting inequality. Yes, that's true. No one seems to care about making the Weasleys less poor.
Yeah.
Like, even Dumbledore is a bit like, yeah, but I need to destroy Voldemort because he's mean and makes everyone be an army. He's not like, kind of like, and also I must really reduce marginal tax rates.
There is no social democratic force within the wizarding world.
No, the priority of the wizarding government is secrecy and keeping wizarding life hidden from muggles. And that's almost a completely contradictory priority to democratic freedom, which is all about transparency and knowing your government and stuff like that. So I think with that priority shifted, that kind of colours the entire politics of Harry Potter, and that's why people don't really know what's going on in their government, because they kind of just trust them to keep everything hidden from muggles. So that's the main point.
But to re-establish my bona fides as a Blairite, there is a big problem with school provision and public sector reform in the Harry Potter universe. There's only one school. As far as I can tell, it's pre the abolition of grammar schools, which, as a good Blairite, I know was a great step forward for education. It's pre the abolition of grammar schools. As far as I can tell, there appears to be this hard and fast 11-plus style test. Are you magical or are you not?
But then you've got owls and whatever the other ones are called. So there is at least...
But Squibs, like, the only people from wizarding families who do not have magical abilities, like Filch, the embittered caretaker, it appears that the only jobs in the wizarding world are low-skill...
Menial,
very far down the value chain, not very productive.
But that leads us, unfortunately, to the idea that, in a sense, what we've got is a kind of apartheid society, which is not an uncomfortable... It's not a comfortable place to take the idea that it's...
what it is.
That it's a kind of... You know, your value as a human being is kind of very much Rod, and this is what I find quite uncomfortable about it. So the sort of idea that you're valuing them with human beings is based on how good you are at magic, but that's not something that you can work at. That's just something that you're gifted. It's like the way that Star Wars went from being like anybody can be a Jedi to then, oh, actually, no, you have to inherit the might of chlorians or whatever it was.
Whoa. I think you're referring to some Star Wars films which don't exist.
Do we not acknowledge the canonicity of the prequels? Well, at that point, I probably should say that it has been decreed by Barbara, who is not with us at the moment, but that Pottermore doesn't count.
Yeah.
Which is fine with me because I've literally never read anything on Pottermore, but I sense for Anna that might be more of a...
No, I agree that Pottermore is not canon, but to go back to what Stephen said about the 11 plus idea, there is no test. You just are on a magical list if you're magic when you're born, which is really just like, if you're born magic, you can go to the school, you can participate in society, you can do all these other things. If you're not, we do not care about
it. But that's
you.
Very cruel, isn't it? Like, if you're the hugely only squib in a family of five, like, if one of the Weasleys just turned out to have no magical ability, the sense of alienation from their essentially their whole family and their whole family's social circle would be incredible.
And to a lesser extent, this is what you see in the tragedy of Dumbledore's family, is that his sister is unable to control her magical powers, and they try and, like, contain her in the house and lock her away, and then she ends up dying in like a magical fight. It's all, you know, terrible and horrible.
Which book did that happen
in the seventh book? You find
I
out.
Really, we're skipping through that, obviously. Yeah. At that point,
I mean, the seventh book is bad.
Oh no! What are you saying?
Book drags. I mean, those interminable camping scenes, and then Harry, who by this point is one of fiction's greatest monsters, to the point when they're trying to make Ron seem unsympathetic. J.K. Rowling is massively plays favourites with her three protagonists. She locks Hermione in an unlovely marriage, right? Just like, I'm sorry,
how could you be becoming minister for magic?
She shouldn't be marrying either of those dweebs, both of whom would die about 30 times if it weren't for her, because they're too lazy to read Hogwarts history. If I was by book five, I would just completely lost it. So why won't you ever read Hogwarts
I bought you a copy of the book. I left it on your pillow. Please.
It's laminated on cards.
I put post-it notes on the important pages. Please read it.
Yeah, that is, yeah. Well, that's. I think I sense that might be a theme that comes up throughout our discussions, is the fact that Harry is in some ways one of the most boring protagonists. Mm. That's probably enough politics chat. The next section will be economy with John Ellidge and Caroline Crampton, but we'll be hearing more from Stephen and Anna later when we talk a little bit about fan fiction education and the ending. Now it's time to look at the economy in Harry Potter, for which City Metric editor John Ellidge and web editor Caroline Crampton joins us. John, I hear a rumour that you can do a young Hagrid voice.
That was actually a stupid joke I'm slightly regretting making, because I did in fact audition for the part of young Hagrid in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Because at the age of 21 I was considered to be a dead ringer for a young Robbie Coltrane, which is, you know, charming. It's exactly what everyone wants, really.
Yeah, Robbie Coltrane in like a massive beard. That's my favourite bit.
Well, I mean, young Hagrid was very much the point here.
Did young Hagrid ever actually make it into the films?
Yeah, but it's Robbie Coltrane in the dark or something. So it's, yeah.
And they made him smaller, didn't they?
I think they'd in fact cut the part by the time I auditioned, because they gave me the Tom Riddle part to read, and I really didn't look like I was convincingly 16. So
that mean that you saw the Harry Potter script before anyone else?
I saw one scene.
That's quite, yeah. That's cash.
But yeah, I could have been like a fat Robert Pattinson. that I could have had an entirely different career. It could be Robert Pattinson sat here now.
It's about Metro Maps. Yeah. What does he know about Metro Maps, John? Nothing.
I think it's all worked out for the best, really.
That's a really great anecdote. I didn't know you were ever an actor.
Only in a Ponzi student fashion. I'm never a proper actor.
What parts have you played as a Ponzi student actor?
I feel we're getting off topic here.
I don't care.
I mostly got typecast as Shakespearean drunks.
Great typecast.
If it makes you feel better, I went to an all-girls school, so I exclusively played men throughout my teenage years. my Lysander in Midsummer Night's Dream is still much commented upon in the Midlands. Caroline, no, you don't need to tell me about what roles you were forced to play at school and university. Instead, I want to ask you about the idea of a post-scarcity society, which is kind of what the wizarding world appears to be. So there are certain rules, kind of not in a kind of matter cannot be created or destroyed thing, but then that's sort of true, isn't it? You can't create something permanently out of nothing. You can create the illusion of something, or you can make more of something.
Yeah, so this is where we need to get nerdy about Gamp's law of elemental transfiguration. Correct me if I'm wrong, anyone else. But these ideas that there are set rules with magic, that you can't create something out of nothing. If you've got some of something, you can make more of it, but you can't just create. This comes up in the seventh book, particularly when Harry, Ron and Hermione are kind of on the run, and lack of food is a serious problem, and Ron just keeps going to Hermione, "You're good at magic, can't you just make food?" And she's like, "No, that's the whole point of our society, that I actually can't do that."
How has Ron got to that age without learning that?
Well, I feel like that's a real reflection on Ron as a person who's apparently had this incredible prestigious education, and that hadn't sunk in. But anyway,
so he grew up poor. So surely that would have come up at home as well, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like, oh, what's for dinner tonight? Nothing. Well, can't you just make something, Mum? No, because of Graham's laws of elemental transformation. All right, it's good.
Yeah. But anyway, so even in spite of this, you do get the sense in Wizarding Society that kind of lack of resource is not really a problem, right?
Yeah, it doesn't make the slightest bit of sense, if we're honest here.
But it does, though, because, like you say, the Weasleys are poor.
But so, what does poverty mean? I mean, okay,
I've got a rubbish house.
I did actually revise before coming in here right now, so I can tell you that one of the five exceptions under Gamp's law of elemental transfiguration is that you can't make money out of nothing, which is fine, except money isn't a real thing. It's
money
kind of
still gold,
it's,
right?
But currency isn't a real thing.
I know what you mean. The idea
of
money is
something else. It's like the idea of money is meaningless if you can just kind of, you know, magic a hi-fi out of nowhere. Showing my age by going to hi-fi there, aren't I?
But no, but also, I mean, in our world, money doesn't exist in the sense that, like, in lots of computers, there is negligible money technically exists, but what does it really mean? I'm going to get, like, first-year philosophy student, but what does it really mean, though? So yeah. there is that, I mean, money is already a sort of slightly philosophical concept anyway. It's only worth what you can buy with it.
But the point I'm getting at, really, is the idea that, you know, you can't get money out of nowhere. It sort of doesn't matter if you can get stuff out of nowhere, because the only purpose of money is to give you access to stuff.
And also, this also feeds into the Weasley discussion, but more generally, what costs does a wizard have? Like, you can travel for free, you can presumably clothe and house yourself for
nice
free.
Precaution,
your education is free.
Can you clothe and house yourself for free? Because presumably they must still, you can't buy everything. Like, do wizards go to, like, New Look? Or do they buy everything from exclusive rope? Because there must be you would think that there would be wizard fashions, in the sense that if, like, your elders all were very, like, robey, there would be a rebellion movement where you all wore, you know, you were punk. You would have a fashion rebellion, and you would want to go to non... Part of your identity would be going not buying the clothes from the same place as your parents.
Yeah,
like, how many of us buy clothes from the same place our parents buy their clothes?
I probably do now.
But you know what I mean?
Not when I was 16, yeah.
Yeah. It's a really difficult point, but also, and the same thing with housing, you could presumably get free housing by making a little, like, what looks like a barn on the outside. Isn't this the Weasley thing? They have the sort of windmill that looks kind of cack on the outside, but it's actually amazing on the inside.
So they can magic up a luxury tent. I mean, like, it's clearly possible to pull accommodation out of nowhere.
I'm talking about subsistence here. Like, you can subsist effectively just on your magic. Obviously, if you're the Malfoys and you want everything to be made of chased silver, you might actually spring for it.
But how do we think the Malfoys got all their money? How does one become a rich wizard?
I have a theory.
Exploitation.
Exploitation of goblins is my theory. I think way back in centuries ago, some Malfoy, you know, bought a mine and forced a load of goblins to work.
But then presumably had to sell that to Muggles.
I think I can see what John says. He's squiggled down something here about population size, and I think you have to, if you're going to make serious money, presumably you have to translate your wizarding skills, because there's just not enough people for you to accumulate.
But that's what I mean. It's kind of like, so Morocco's got a closed currency, so the idea is you're not supposed to take anything in and out of the country. And I wonder if it's a bit like that with wizard society, like what stuff you allowed to take in and out. Because actually, you know, one of the things that drives growth is having people of working age, But that, none of that really meaningfully makes sense in a Wizarding context.
They all seem to work in the public sector as well, isn't it? Like, most of the jobs you hear about are sort of, you know, Wizarding police and or civil service or
Weasley
so on.
The Weasley twins, who are small business owners and entrepreneurs who leave school early to set up their chain of joke shops, they are considered to be really weird and unusual and probably mad, right?
Yeah, so do wizards pay tax? And is there, like, a special wizard tax? Presumably they don't bother paying, you know, council tax.
Which is probably because they do occasionally use the roads and stuff. That seems a bit cheeky.
I think this comes back to the age-old question of whether wizards can vote in Muggle elections. I don't know if you've discussed that. Are there any other points in this podcast?
We've been there.
But I wondered, right, given that there is...
But they must have plumbing. Like, even if they're... no, but this is the thing. Like, even that Weasley's windmill that doesn't look like a real windmill, they must have plumbing. Mustn't they? So they must involve the using the water supply. Do the Weasleys not have a flush toilet?
They use latrines.
But I think all of this I think because it comes down to a really fundamental question about, for example, is wizard society growing? That's a really interesting question, which I don't think is ever really addressed in the books. Because are they like a sort of Japan where they've got an aging population? You know, are there like wizard care homes? That's never really kind of, they can't do what a modern society like Britain might do, where they bring in lots of immigrants who then make, you know, work and make money and pay tax and then pay to support older people. What is the mechanism for that happening? And fundamentally, if they're having 1.8 children, which is the same number, I mean, obviously not the Weasleys, they're doing their bit. But, you know, if other people are having 1.8 children, that means that wizard society is gradually essentially dying out.
I guess the only way it is growing, and it's not, it is by intermarriage with Muggles. That whilst...
And spontaneous generation, I guess, yeah. Like a Hermione who is just randomly...
Exactly. But no matter how many children that kind of mixed marriage has, you've incorporated another adult into your community by doing that.
Yeah, although I've never really got the hang of how sort of mixed race marriages work in Harry Potter and how much the Muggle partner is kind of allowed into the whole club.
Well, there's a few that are shown to not work at all. Like, I think, isn't it Seamus Finnegan... he relates later on in the books that he has this, where I think it's his mum who's the witch, and his dad's Muggle, and he left her when he found out that she was a witch, and so he grew up just with a single parent.
So she pretended that she wasn't magical. That's a kind of great metaphor, isn't it, for like patriarchy and stuff, is that she had to, like, I'm not going to get into that sort of thing about the thing in Friends where Phoebe gives them a lecture about, you know, like, don't hide your wind. but, you know, that she felt that she didn't want to threaten him as a man. And then, unfortunately, it turned out that she was more powerful than him and he couldn't handle that.
Maybe he was just pissed off that she had all these magical powers and she hadn't been using them to generate stuff. I mean, it's a post-scarcity society. It's like he wanted, like, an iPad or something.
That could have been true. As he, like, laboured in the shed making, you know, help, or, like, painting the, with a, laboriously painting the front room. He might have gone, like, you could have said something.
That took me 3 weeks.
I'm terrible at wallpapering. Yeah, so I guess that might be the thing as well. Just to finish, John, I just want to ask you, what jobs outside the public sector do you think that a wizarding society would need or could support?
It's really difficult to envision. I mean, again, it's... This all feels like a sort of category error because we haven't got past the post-scarcity thing. Like, if the only things you can't pull out of nowhere are food and money doesn't mean anything. I suppose farming. Maybe there are wizard farmers.
One thing I can think of is sort of, like, fancy expertise and stuff. So when Bill and Fleur get married at the beginning of the seventh book, there are, like, fancy caterers and obviously some company that they've hired to make the fancy magic wedding tent. So obviously we know that some wizards are better at some kinds of magic
Etsy.
Than others.
That's basically you're saying is so there's a massive wizard Etsy.
Yeah, that sort of, like, crafting. Luxury specialists and stuff, I can imagine. So same goes for, like, the clothes. So
yeah, and people who do the fireworks and stuff
exactly.
like that.
Everyone can make a cloak, but this woman is Vivian Westwood and she's really good at making cloaks kind of thing.
Except if she was in the book, she'd have to be called, like, Renmingly Westwood or something. Sorry, I just, the names, I can't get over the names sometimes. I'm sure we'll return to some of the themes that we've touched on here, but thank you very much to John and Caroline. We now move on to the subject of education, which makes sense as the majority of the Harry Potter books take place at Hogwarts, a slightly strange boarding school that seems to be somewhere in Scotland. I'm joined by Barbara Speed and Stephanie Boland. First of all, what do you make of Hogwarts's curriculum, Stephanie?
I think it's fundamentally pedagogically unsound, to be
okay,
to
good.
Be fair. The obvious hole in the Hogwarts curriculum is the core skills of English and maths do not seem to be taught at Hogwarts. I don't know if they're integrated into other learning objectives and, you know,
I don't see how you would do a potions thing and then, like, could be like, today is potions and algebra, or, like, today is potions and quadratic equations. It doesn't really... I know what you mean. Everyone seems to be speak very... Like, everyone is very posh there in the sense of, like, they're very... You use the right fork and they, you know, they all sort of have a very good vocabulary and all those kind of soft skills that a public school is supposed to teach you without that ever seem to be integrated into the lesson plan.
No, not at all. And it's we were just discussing earlier in the office, there also seems to be very little in the way of vocational subjects, which is weird given that almost everyone in the wizarding world seems to go on to work in the public sector.
But then again, maybe they do English and maths, because you know that whole episode where it turns out Hermione's had the time turner and she's been able to go to four times as many lessons.
Is it just her going to English lessons on
well,
her
I don't
own?
Know, but I just don't know how there could be that many other lessons that you wouldn't be able to fit into. Like, you know, I took 11 GCSEs. That was... I don't think they've ever named more than 11 subjects that they had.
There's definitely not more than 11 subjects, but there are scenes where we see them get their timetables, and there doesn't seem to be...
And each teacher, I mean, there are a limited number of teachers, and you meet all of them. So how they manage to teach all the students is another question for another day.
The biology teacher. Yeah, well, exactly.
Their union must be really...
Maybe
hungry.
They've all got time turners.
The Hogwarts tenure.
They could do, yeah, maybe.
That's very true, actually. There seems to be one teacher per subject. And yes. No, yeah, and that's that doesn't necessarily really stack up in terms of how many students are there at Hogwarts.
It's actually got to be very this small if you problem. Think of the men and the number of girls and boys in each.
But yeah, if you think of the number of wizards that are implied to live in the UK, it doesn't add up. Like, I think that this is why work on the films must have been fascinating, because you'd have been going to J.K. Rowling, being like, how many rooms are we putting in this castle, J.K.? Like, this is not adding up at all. How many classrooms are there? There can't be more than, what, 13 classrooms? Because why
how many
would
people
you
are there
more?
Per year,
right,
per house?
So there's five boys in the Gryffindor dorm. Hang on, Anna looks like this is something she definitely knows.
Okay, let's bring in. I think this is like countdown. Let's appeal to the expert. Let's bring Anna here, who knows.
No, sorry, I think Stephanie's absolutely right. I think there's about 10 girls and boys in each house in each year, so about 40 to a year. Seems about
that's 7 years.
Of students.
And 7 years, yeah. So
280, and so yeah, you could realistically have about 11 or 12 lessons going on at once.
That implies a very small wizarding population in Britain, though, doesn't it? If you think that, if you work forward on all those kind of cohorts. Although I guess there are also ones in Bulgaria and people like that. But there's no suggestion that Durmstrang or whatever the other schools are called, like, are bigger, are there? So
there's a weird bit where Draco's mum considers sending him there. Because
it's a bit sort of fascist.
Riddled with scum.
And that, I do sort of think that Hogwarts is maybe a bit like a sort of Montessori school. Like, it's sort of kind of like, you know, it's supposed to be kind of like, well, like Stowe has always had that reputation in terms of boarding schools. It's like the one where, like, maybe people do, like, drop out and smoke loads of Ouija, but, like, it's like a rounded education, yeah?
It's a bit more holistic.
Yeah, that's the kind of, I think
well,
that's probably its reputation.
None of them seem to have gone to primary school. So presumably they're giving them all their social skills on top of everything else. There's no... It's sort of suggested the Weasleys are homeschooled.
Yes, what is the feeder school for Hogwarts? Because obviously
never,
presumably like, Harry goes to a normal school.
I think they just don't go to
school. I think
school.
They don't go unless they're a mudblood. Sorry to use that word. In which case... in
so
which
offended.
Case they would go to a normal school. But there's no higher education either.
But that's a huge burden on, like, I mean, you'd imagine it would fall on women as well, on wizarding women that they have to homeschool their kids.
Yeah.
Are there wizard nurseries? Or there?
Take them along to
was
the ministry.
Was it preschool?
Yeah, it was a preschool.
Adorable.
What's the ministry controls everything. They must have some kind of
but that's also
there.
A kind of interesting point. I mean, we were talking about the idea about the fact that, you know, Dumbledore's sister couldn't control her magic. But actually, like, when your magic appears, presumably you're not instantly, like... Yeah, I don't know if you've ever been to a normal nursery. It's or like a soft play area. Heaven forbid if you've ever been to the Wacky Warehouse. But imagine like that, but with as well as all the kind of sick, they were also like letting off little spells accidentally. Because I presume you don't have full control of your magic.
No,
initially.
They definitely don't. That's why you have the opening scene, where he accidentally lets a snake loose. Mm.
But that's what I mean. Running a wizard nursery, like a kindergarten, must be not a job for the faint of heart.
No, yeah. Although I guess the adults are also magical. It'd be more of a problem if you had a magical child in a mainstream
comprehension. This is why surely they don't go to muggle schools.
Hmm.
Because that's yeah. exactly what
But is the idea that particularly that puberty brings on magic?
Well, that's the implication, isn't it? Because that whole first book is kind of a weird sort of coming-of-age story in which he stops defining himself by his family hating him and instead defines himself by magic, which they detect in him and see him as really special. But that age 11 is very, like...
Because I guess that... I don't think that is the case, because I think he's probably too young, but it kind of makes sense. You know, like... In his Dark Materials, that the whole thing about your demon and your demon only fixes really when you first feel kind of sexual love for someone else, really, like that's, you know, it's or pre kind of sexual love when you're a young teenager, that's, you know, that's a qualitative difference as you're becoming an adult, that your personality becomes fixed in some way. I wonder if it's supposed to be the same thing, in which case you would think that there would be kind of a, most societies you would then anthropologically expect them to have some kind of ritual that happened to you. Like, you know, the way that Catholics have First Communion and Jewish community has Bar or Bat Mitzvahs, you'd kind of expect that to be built in, and I don't see any evidence of that, like, you know, Tommy's first spell day or whatever.
But the letter comes when you show signs of magic. The letter is almost a kind of ritual, and obviously the fact it's made such a big deal for Harry by the Dursleys refusing him to see it makes it even more of a thing.
To ask a very banal question... Stephanie, would Hogwarts pass its Ofsted inspection?
I don't think so. I think it's, you know, its learning outcomes are too uncertain. I think the assessment criteria aren't transparent in any way. You can get 200% in an exam. You
and
know, this is a failing school.
Is it closer to a grammar school or a free school?
I would say a free. I it's a public school, isn't it? And because another thing we were discussing when brainstorming this podcast is how much freedom and control the teachers have within the school environment. You know, there's until the introduction of Umbridge, who comes in from the ministry and starts to.
That's what I mean.
Some
it's quite,
regulations.
It is quite a free school in the sense that there is obviously there's no oversight structure. There's no kind of super school. You know, so it is directly responsible to the Secretary of State. So in that sense, it's like a free school. But it is like a grammar school in the sense that there is a kind of 11 plus and admission is only on ability.
And you do seem to have state-administered exams, so you have OWLS and NEWTs, so you have GCSEs and A-levels, which are externally assessed. So there's a strange... I don't know why they'd need to be externally assessed, given that there's no other wizarding school in the country.
There must be a terrific amount of teaching to the test, wasn't there, given that I'm sure that the same people who set them and mark them, you know, this pretty... Given how small the wizarding community are, you must pretty much know the people
who
set...
Know the examiners. Yeah, it's another classic example of nepotism in the wizarding world of Harry Potter, really.
But equally, I mean, none of the teachers can be qualified because they don't have any teaching universities or universities.
There's no
at
teach
all.
First. There's no wizards teach first.
No, exactly. So that is, again, more like a public school where
qualifications.
And this is so interesting what you're saying about there being no higher education. You know, you must do a tremendous amount of on-the-job training.
Well, I mean, Aura is trained for 3 years post-school. Although the real question is whether Harry had to go back and take his
He didn't. He didn't finish. And Hermione did. Him and Ron didn't go back.
So he was therefore trained without even a full secondary education.
I think you would probably say exceptional circumstances. But that's interesting because, so in the later Terry Pratchett books, obviously there's the Unseen University there, which is a magical university. And they have a bit that happens, you see the Unseen University is already in there from since like the third book, Equal Rights. But later on, we get to a stage where you get Ponda Stibbons essentially trying to kind of create, like, understand the kind of theoretical underpinnings, and eventually they begin to regard magic more and more like quantum physics. So they have this big computer that they kind of they think can be that can kind of, and people are kind of essentially doing like PhD level research and postdoc research on magic. Everyone seems to be like wildly uncritical about magic as a sort of theoretical discipline. They just inherit spells that at some point someone has discovered. Are there people actively looking for new spells?
See, there definitely are, because we know that Dumbledore's done research. He seems to be in contact with other people who do frontline research. Mm. And you have people like Snape annotating his school textbook in the...
Although he didn't feed that into a better later edition of the textbook, despite being the potions master some time.
But there's definitely that idea that there's a theoretical underpinning you can access and manipulate.
But there's also a complete lack of interest in doing that, in that they're encouraged not to do anything outside the curriculum. Snape's doing naughty things by kind of inventing these other spells or discovering these other
spells.
Yeah,
it's actually very...
There's all those banned books. Like, they're not actually encouraging them to think
beyond...
It's
very pre-enlightenment. It's, only, yeah. It's like, this is the, like, the, these are the teachings. It's a very kind of, like, this Master is the word of the book that you accept and you do it and you don't, you're not encouraged to kind of critical thinking or anything that's outside of what we currently know, which is a very oddly, like, static kind of state for a society to be in. It's not very... It's one that you imagine might actually be quite stultifying to live in, that there are a lot of you know, bad books.
And also that the magic is uncontrollable as a young person and then is later controlled. And then even later on, Harry's kind of taught that you can sort of do magic just by, like, thinking about it. Which, again, the fact that they're taught these, like, selective spells begins to look quite...
That comes back to the idea, and we were talking in a previous section about what happens in nursing, like nursing homes, and presumably at the end of your life, for a certain percentage of wizards, they would become, you know, they would get dementia, and they would again lose the ability to control their spells. Now, I would like to hear more about, like, what happens to really old wizards who, like, lose their marbles, essentially?
Go to St. Mungo's.
Yeah, the only palliative care we see is Gilderoy Lockhart, who has lost his mind. But he doesn't seem to... He just kind of dodders around. He doesn't start turning things into...
Do wizards get cancer? And if so, can they cure it? Like, what do wizards die of? Apart from...
In battle.
Yeah, exactly, like giant snakes. That's one of the things I don't...
They do die of old age, because Nicholas Flamel stops taking the Philosopher's
Stone. I was going to say, but that's what I don't understand. So Nicholas Flamel has obviously quietly been, like, living for ages and ages and ages.
Yeah.
But actually, what... Presumably, you could cure cancer through magical means. That wouldn't transgress the laws. So what do you die of, eventually?
Well, they obviously have medical care, and it's funny, it's quite sort of herb-based, but judging by what they use in Hogwarts.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And I remember when Harry, his arm is cursed. Mm. And she kind of says, oh, if this had happened a different way, it would be much worse. So there are obviously limits to what they can do.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure what those are.
Well, they live amongst a lot of dangerous creatures, so I wonder how many of them... It's like an extreme version of Australia in Hogwarts, where kind of everything wants to kill you.
Mm.
I wonder, when your time comes, do you just wander off into the forest?
Well, also, I mean...
Say hello to the big spider.
Yeah, come at me, Aragorn.
And Dumbledore puts Harry in so much peril that you kind of hope that they do have a better medical system that could...
They have a six-week referral limit. Well, on that... Again, bombshell. Thank you for the moment very much to Stephanie and Barbara. We turn now to the subject of sex and relationships in Harry Potter, for which I'm joined by Stephen Bush once again and Anna Leskovitz. I'm going to talk to you first, because I think it's really important, about feminism during Harry Potter. Do you consider Harry Potter to be feminist works, Anna?
Well, I've never really thought about that before. I think it can get quite messy when you decide, like, this is a feminist thing with a capital F and this is not.
Is it? Are they books that are interested in the position of women? I guess that's a more interesting question.
I think, obviously, the most interesting character we have for that is Hermione, who is shown to consistently outperform her male peers. And get little credit for it. So although that's not a very positive outlook, it's clear that she does face some sort of obstacles based on her gender that Harry and Ron get a lot of glory for their bravery and these other masculine qualities.
And it does seem like a society where women can rise to the top. I'm not sure have there ever been a female minister for magic?
I mean, I'm sure you could find an example in Pottermore or something like that, but there's certainly not one that's made a big
female
deal
female head of Hogwarts?
I think it's strongly implied that McGonagall takes over at some point. So, and a lot of the most powerful witches.
McGonagall is like the Nicola Sturgeon of Harry Potter. Don't you think she's just kind of quietly efficient, and Dumbledore is basically sort of making like these grand gestures all the time, and she's just like, "Oh no, but someone's just got to run the school." If you don't mind, Albus.
Yeah, I mean, most of a lot of the female characters, especially the female teachers like McGonagall and Madame Pomfrey and people like that, are shown to be extremely competent, more competent than their.
But there I think there are two characters which are hashtag problematic, and those are Dolores Umbridge and Rita Skeeter, because I think they're both caricatured in a particular way. They are, like, the symbols of femininity are kind of used, like, because there's all the stuff about Rita Skeeter's, like, glasses and her nails and her, you know, her lipstick and all this kind of stuff, and you get the same thing with Umbridge, and there's a big thing about you can read female character through how women dress. I think that's a kind of interesting thing that is rarely explored.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true that, you know, the boys are repulsed by Umbridge's pink bows and pink frilly dresses and all the cats in her room because they see her as not authentically feminine because she's also mean and evil.
And ugly
and toad-like. And a similar thing happens with Rita Skeeter where they find her sort of nails and snakeskin bags and red lips and stuff repulsive because she doesn't conform to what they would expect from a woman. Those are definitely problematic characters.
So Stephen, I know you've got strong feelings about the relationship between Ron and Hermione, which is one of the kind of central relationships in the book. Aren't they just the cutest couple?
No! She's too good for him. I mean, the story of Harry Potter is the story of one, like, really together woman and these two
ages.
Utterly... Yeah, just... I mean, Harry doesn't listen to anyone. The number of problems, and indeed the number of people who die because Harry doesn't listen to other people and continually just goes, "Oh, my parents are dead." Or, I mean, a large part of Book 7 is Harry refusing to accept the idea that his teachers might have private lives. This is a 17-year-old man. And Ron resents Harry for being famous. He comes from a family, which, as we know, there is clearly something sinister going on there. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with being the Dennis Thatcher to Hermione's Margaret, but I don't think that he's willing for that. I think he's going to undermine her. He's going to keep her down. He's going to hold her
back.
He's going to neg her, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting... There is an interesting point about it, because obviously it's young adult fiction, particularly from the mid, you know, sort of... Goblet of Fire? No, was it a Goblet of?
It's Goblet of Fire, correct, where it does feel like she's suddenly gone, wow, they've gone old.
Turn on the sex tap, because things are smouldering in the corridors. But then you get a lot about rejection, and that's... And I think it's quite interesting because you do get more male subjectivity. So you hear a lot about how Harry is sad about the fact that Cho Chang prefers Cedric Diggory to him. And then you hear quite a lot about how Ron is sad that Fleur Delacour doesn't like him. You don't hear necessarily so much about Hermione. I mean, there's one bit where she sort of bursts into tears and then she goes, "Oh, Ron, how could you not have seen that I was really upset about this?"
Yeah, she gets very angry when Ron gets a new girlfriend and she makes angry birds fly at his head. But that is literally sort of that we're meant to just glean her whole subjectivity from those kind of incidents. Harry is perhaps implied more likely to talk about these kinds of things with Ron, and it is really from Harry's point of view. So maybe that's one explanation why we get a lot more male subjectivity. But yeah, there's sort of... the idea that Hermione the whole way through the books is sort of suppressing and dealing with these feelings, but it's probably more interesting. That's the most interesting part of their group dynamic, and yet we don't really see any of it.
And you don't see a lot of women in the books having conversations with each other about something other than man, to quote that kind of Bechdel test.
Yeah, if you looked at it in that regard, I think it would be it's a real problem, because I mean, there's very few scenes that Harry's not in, so it'd be quite hard to have a scene with two women apart from, you know, all the flashbacks, all the bits with Voldemort, things like that. But yeah, that women, the issue at the heart of the books is this power struggle between two men, and all the conversations in some way seem to keep coming back to that. And yeah, you don't really get much of a female perspective on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And what about in terms of not kind of compulsory heterosexuality? I'm aware this is sounding a bit like a Slate piece. Like, is Harry Potter heterosexist? But it is an overwhelmingly straight world. Whereas if you think, if this was a kind of, I don't know, but it comes back to the idea of a post-scarcity society. You think it might be, why is it so kind of socially conservative in some ways? Why is it not like people just lounging about in divans having sex with each other all the time? Why does everyone get married and settle down?
Well, We forget that it is set during the 80s, well, the early 90s. You know, the book ends in 1996, 97? It ends in the late 90s, so, you know, so a lot of that would...
What you're saying is the Wizarding World needs Tony Blair.
The Wizarding World needs Tony Blair. I mean, there is no problem he can't solve.
Would they have voted for him?
If they could vote can in Muggle elections.
I don't know, Claire Short, Minister for Magic. But yeah, this is a Britain before this kind of liberalisation. It's before the kind of equalisation of the age of consent. It's a dark 90s world.
I guess that is the thing that it brings up, is that although I guess because I read it when I was younger, I didn't really fully appreciate how much society's changed, but you were still getting newspaper articles about kind of like pufters in the 90s. That was kind of still the thing that happened. Like you say, the age of consent hadn't been legalised. We certainly didn't have gay marriage or even civil partnerships in the 1990s. It was actually just that particular strand of society has moved on really very quickly.
I think that is a fairly generous view, because obviously writing in the noughties, J.K. Rowling could have, you know, if she felt that was why she was excluding gay characters, could have maybe discussed that somehow. Dumbledore, for example, she says he's gay, but it's not specified anywhere in the book. Or if people think that Sirius was in love with James, and that's where a lot of that conflict comes from.
They are oddly sexless. It does feel that basically the characters in Harry Potter only experience sexual desire. Kind of, it is like these weird patterns. So there's the kind of Sweet Valley Hogwarts effect in book 6. But even that is on these really weird straight lines. So Hermione likes Ron, Ron likes Hermione. They don't tell each other. So does Hermione even find an alternative boyfriend, or does she just...
She's with Victor Crumb for a while.
But in book 6, I think she just fulminates about it.
Yeah.
And then Ron finds someone who likes him, but he likes her, and they go out. Actually, their relationships are entirely through diagonals. Even sort of the Cho Chang thing, Harry spends a year pining over her. She chooses someone else who dies. They spend a kind of year with the world's most awkward and terrible relationship.
But he already kind of was slightly interested in Ginny Weasley, or she was certainly very interested in him from book 2.
Ginny Weasley's definitely, yeah, that's another one where it's like, oh, all unrequited love will eventually
come
good.
Well, that's
a
very weird thing. Like, how many couples do you know in real life who actually first fell in love when they were 11 or 14?
Yeah, it's an odd thing. I mean, I think the implied thing is that Harry's not meant to notice until... You know, notice Ginny at all until she's, you know, of an acceptably...
But I remember talking to Danny Dorling, who's a professor of human geography, and he says, you know, he now teaches at my old college, and he said, you know, I get all these kids who come here, and I want to say to them, you know, in their first year, like, how many of you are in a relationship?
That won't last. Break up with them now.
But
yeah.
It's very true. Very few relationships, even from university, survive. You know, people are taking longer and longer to settle down with their partners. It's very anomalous that apparently what happens in the Wizarding World is that everyone at 17, it's kind of...
meets through school.
Slightly kind of like Mormon in the sense. It's very, you know, it's what I mean about it being quite a conservative society. And that is of a piece with the fact that kind of Dumbledore is the kind of Ted Heath, essentially. Like, it's like he has no private life, and then people later project back onto it and then say, well, actually, it's quite liberal. But the whole point is, if you don't, you know, if no one's allowed to talk about it at the time, it's not evidence of any great liberalism.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll all agree. I don't know, I've talked myself around to the idea that the Harry Potter books are actually really weirdly socially conservative on sex relationships.
Because they are ultimately books about school. With this kind of...
You're really undermining the premise of us projecting a huge amount of like social discourse onto them. We're going, yeah, but aren't they just
breaking,
like...
breaking the fourth wall here. The teachers don't have an inner life in that. So I've now lived in Stoke Newington for some time, but I've discovered recently one of my old English teachers, who there is a non-trivial possibility listens to this podcast, in which case I'm sorry, lives there. And it's one of those weird moments where you see your teacher and it's like, no, but you're not allowed to exist.
You don't exist outside
the real world.
As Tina Fey says in Mean Girls, it's like seeing a dog walk on its hind legs.
Yeah, but I'm sure like everyone remembers that moment. I remember the first time that we were in our like one of Worcester's premier night spots, and then our physics teacher walked in, and you were like, what is going on? This is like, no, you know, at 5 p.m. on a Friday, you disapparate. We let you go and, I don't know, knit or something. That's one thing I want to cover, just to finish up, Anna, on this segment, is the idea of consent, which is...
worryingly drawn.
So this idea of love potions, first of all, that you would teach 13 and 14-year-olds how to make other people fall in love with them and override their own free will. Or is the idea that love potions can only reveal what's really in your heart anyway? Is that the way to kind of get around it?
No.
Like hypnotism can't make you murder someone. It can only...
Love potions are sort of only shown to have messy ends in the books, which is why you're like, well, why is it on the curriculum for young children then? But for example, Tom Riddle's mother fell in love with Tom Riddle's father in the village that she was growing up in, and he's a muggle, and she, you know, it's implied that she either uses a love potion or has him under the Imperius curse, and that's how she keeps him for years and years and years, and then she thinks that, oh, well, yes, exactly, I will have revealed what's really in his heart all along, and then he wakes up from the spell and is like, oh my god, what is going on? And
is
obviously,
this child
departs immediately. Romilda Vane gives Ron a poisoned box of chocolates that just goes terribly.
Yeah, I would not put this on the pre-GCSE curriculum.
No, it's problematic in not just because it's not successful, but because obviously it depends upon, you know, overriding the idea that other human beings have consent. So yeah, that's quite, it's a big problem.
Okay, well, on that note, I think that's probably enough sex and relationships for now. Thank you for the moment, very much to Stephen and Anna. And now we've nearly come to the end of our time with Harry Potter and the books. Let's just have a little chat about the epilogue, a very controversial part of the book, I think it's fair to say. I'm joined by Caroline Crampton and Stephanie Boland. So, Caroline, first of all, tell us what happens in the epilogue. So, the end of the book's proper, Snape dead, Voldemort defeated, quite a lot of people that you quite liked, including that nice one of the Weasley twins.
Also dead, yep.
And then
Battle of Hogwarts concluded, the good guys have won, Bellatrix Lestrange is dead, all of that. That's the end of the books proper. And then 19 years later, we get this sort of 2 or 3 page epilogue, which features an all-grown-up Harry, Hermione, Ron, Ginny, seeing their kids off on the platform at King's Cross onto the Hogwarts Express. I can't remember exactly, but a couple of their kids are going to Hogwarts for the first time. So it's kind of a mirror back to what the first book, when, you know, Harry and Ron and Hermione were going for the first time.
You know, there are problems, aren't there?
You see a few, like, familiar faces. We see Draco Malfoy kind of through the stupid. It's just awful. I'm trying to treat this seriously before we get into it, but I just can't.
But the truth is there any sense that, like, maybe just because it's relatively quite a small world, the Wizarding World, that Harry and Draco have maybe just kind of grown up a bit and kind of let sleeping dogs lie rather than having a massive running feud?
They share a glance on the platform, and I think there's
But
a
they
sense
must run into each other, not least like sort of parent evils.
Parent-teacher association at Hogwarts.
But I think, so there are many problems with this epilogue, not least that it is just ridiculous, because obviously J.K. Rowling has spent decades of her life in this world now, and she wants everyone to have as happy an ending as possible. So she wants to name check everyone. So there's an awful lot of that kind of, like, Harry shares a glance with Draco, we see X over there. It's all very kind of overly explanatory. There's also the fact that Harry and Ginny have named their sons after as many people who died in the battle as possible. So that one of them's called Albus Severus. You know, they've all got names that cast back, which are just, I think,
just as well they're going to a special school, isn't it, really?
Yeah, Draco has at least, oh, he's called his kid Scorpius, which whilst, okay, whilst,
come on, you can't shout that out in Waitrose.
No, whilst a crazy name is at least the kid's own name, not the names of dead famous people that everyone has heard of that you are now, you know. And then kind of some of the dialogue between Harry and Ron is really forced. You wonder, like, would they still be such good friends 19 years later? And then also the other thing to mention is that the way, part of what colours this is the way that it was done in the film adaptation, where the then, I think, 19-year-old Daniel Radcliffe and the other actors were all kind of given cheek padding and, like, slightly salt and pepper wigs to kind of play the 20-year-older versions of themselves. And
that just sounds innately hilarious.
It's just hilarious, and I don't know, it's just like a real, it really, like, slams you in right at the end, where you think, oh, that was a great saga, I really enjoyed that. Oh, wait, no, this is terrible.
Stephanie, I can see that Caroline's angry about the epilogue. Are you angry about the epilogue too?
I'm angry on the same levels and on other levels as Caroline is angry. Because, I think aside from the ridiculous names, because you're right, at least Scorpius obeys.
Scorpius is such a bear. Sounds like a makeup trainer. It's so bad.
But at least it obeys the ridiculous naming conventions of the Malfoy clan. I mean, nobody in that family but has
But at some point, are they going to run out of scary animals? Is one of them, presumably one of them's called, like, Spideros, and, like, I don't know, Earwiggus.
Arachnus or something.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly, just like Latin and Greek names of slightly unpleasant animals.
But also, it doesn't fit with the narrative of those stories at all, because the whole driving force of Harry Potter is a world that's pretty nasty. So if you get to the end and just go, suddenly everything's fine and there's no further conflict in the world, it's infuriating. It completely
is. And
disobeys.
It also, some of what is good about the seventh book is that we get a lot of the sense that for the generation above Harry and Ron and Hermione, and even above that, the Grindelwald conflict in the sort of in the Second World War was there. Voldemort. That was another kind of battle for the soul of the Wizarding
World. just assume. For the sake of argument that I don't know what the Grindelwald conflict is.
Grindelwald was a previous evil wizard who also Dumbledore's kind of childhood friend and then later nemesis, who had some really Aryan ideas about also.
What we've learned here is that Dumbledore's got terrible judgment.
Yeah, that is the whole point of the whole book.
Or if you have a universe populated by magic people who can do infinitely terrible things, a certain number of them are going to do this, and you cannot have a nice utopia in a British school. It doesn't work.
The point is that they establish all the way through the seventh book is that, you know, good and evil come in waves, and this was just the latest evil that human beings are always going to make terrible decisions. And then, as you say, in the epilogue, it's like, oh, wait, no, but actually it was fine after
So this is the idea that the final lines are, you know, Harry's scar hadn't hurt for X number of years, and all was well.
All was well.
But presumably the feeling is that at some point another, he hasn't defeated all evil in the world forever.
Apparently he has, though, according to the epilogue.
But he's still working as an aura, so it doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. What do you awe if there's nothing to be awed?
I sort of imagine, right, that the aura office is a lot like a kind of slacking off New York Police Department office. Like, they eat a lot of donuts, they don't move around much. They put
sit out on stakeouts, like in Beverly Hills Cop.
There's just nothing, because if all is well, then there's no evil, right?
Or maybe it's like the police on the Isle of Scilly, where it's like a goose has gone missing, we have to go get it back.
Yeah.
Like, or there was actually a report just recently of one of the Scottish Isles, Canada. They had their first crime in 50 years, and someone stole some woolly hats.
And maybe that happens at Hogwarts. That kind of level,
very low level.
Pudding's gone missing.
But it's also, I think, worth mentioning that this is not just Stephanie and I who feel like this. EWE is a very much used tag in Harry Potter chat on the internet in fanfiction, which stands for Epilogue. What Epilogue? If you see any thread or fic tagged with that, it means it is non-epilogue compliant. The author has pretended that the epilogue didn't exist and has operated without it. It's really everywhere.
You just want to go in like the guy at the beginning of Dead Poets Society and rip it out of all of the books and then continue.
It's really funny though, because isn't it? Because you can apply that kind of same principle to lots of other heroic man narratives. So think about, I mentioned in the previous episode, Star Wars, I think, you know, they all, which finishes them getting all their lovely medals. What you don't see then is Luke Skywalker going to take a sort of mid-ranking index-linked pension job in the Galactic Alliance. It's probably not even the right name for it. I'm going to get letters. But you know what I mean? And then there's cut to him in 30 years staring out of his window, sort of eyeing up his secretary and playing with one of those things where you hit the ball and it hits the other balls. And then they just I'm just wondering what happened with his life and how great it was.
I think there is a great opportunity, as you say, to talk about like the afterlife of the hero. If the hero doesn't die in battle defeating the evil, what does he do next?
Just a very banal, normal existence.
What the epilogue shows is, yeah, he lives a really banal kind of...
But maybe that's a judgment on us as readers, that we would rather have him die than have him just be blandly happy.
Do you think he gave his kids those names so their bullying will bring some spice back into his middle life?
I don't know if it's intentional, but that is definitely what is happening.
Would you rather that Harry Potter had died?
Yeah.
I'm on the fence about this. I Stephanie does make a very strong case for this, and I do think that she has a good argument. But I think another way of doing it would also have been for him to have to settle down into his humdrum life, but him not to like it, for it to have been rubbish, for him to have probably had a bit of PTSD, have some difficulties, maybe had depression. You know,
that's kind of a Sue Townsend book you're writing there.
Would you not read that?
I definitely would read that. But yeah. So what's your strong case for that he should be ended?
Because I think as the final Horcrux, you have to commit to the Horcrux status of Harry and kill him off. And
how do they get around the whole he's the Horcrux, therefore we have to destroy him?
Because the part of Voldemort's soul in him died, but his corporeal body did not need to die to extinguish that part.
It's bloody convenient, a very skeptical face right isn't now, it really?
And I think Neville should have killed Voldemort, because I think The Rise of Neville Longbottom is the great beauty of Book 6 and 7.
Do you know, I think that is, in a way, that would have been a really beautiful message that is antithetical to the idea that we've talked about earlier on in the politics section about the idea that wizarding is something that you're born with. You know, it's not, some people just are squibs and tough. You know, actually your worth as a human being is determined by something over which you have kind of no control. And I think that had that happened and Neville kind of been the hero, in a way, it would have said, actually, what matters really is not being born into a manifest destiny. You're not born the boy, you know, the boy who lived, but being somebody who just mucked in and just had to get on with doing things. You know, that's what heroism really is. It's not being kind of the most special person ever and anointed by destiny. It's just being the right person at the right time will take a hard decision.
And also, it would have played into that idea more that Harry's side was a team. That they were facing a lone evil, but he had friends, he had support, and ultimately he had someone to step in when he couldn't.
I would also probably have accepted like Neville stepping in and Neville dying, because I think that would have made sense. But I would less so. Mm. There's that whole business about they were both born on the same day, and it could have turned out to be Neville.
Yeah, the prophecy could have applied to either of them, but Voldemort picked out Harry.
Good slightly smug-faced knowledge. I can meet you, so you're both like, no, that's actually, no. Well, on that bombshell that I don't know as much about Harry Potter as my colleagues, which I think has been admirably demonstrated over the course now of many minutes, thank you very much to Stephanie and to Caroline, and indeed to all the rest of our team. Welcome to the final instalment of our Harry podcast. I'm going to talk a bit about fan fiction now with Stephen Bush and Caroline Crampton, our web editor. Stephen, you've written some Harry Potter fan fiction, haven't you?
I have. I'm a long time ago. As a teenager, I was a big fan fictioner. I've written Harry Potter fan fiction. I wrote Doctor Who fan fiction. I've written some Final Fantasy fan fiction. I don't understand why I'm broadcasting this on the internet, but apparently I am.
But you've never ever written any Labour Party fan fiction, and you want that on the record.
I mean, basically I write Labour Party fan fiction now. It's an exciting universe where they might get their act together.
But just for anybody who's... I'm sure no one listening to a Harry Potter podcast is insufficiently nerdy to know what fan fiction is, but I think people maybe aren't so into the idea of the scale of how much fan fiction there are thousands upon thousands,
hundreds of thousands. Harry Potter is, I think, one of the biggest fandoms on the internet, mostly down to the fact that it came of age at exactly the right point in the technological progression,
and because she inconsiderately had a baby, there was that gap, the so-called long summer, as it was dubbed in fan circles, where basically it became this thing to, you know, write the next chapters, write the next book, explore some of the themes.
Was that between 4 and 5?
Yeah, it was between 4 and 5. And so we knew there was the looming ghost of Voldemort still to come, having been brought back. But there was this big old gap. And also, of course, with 4, you know, there's that slight... Cedric and Cho, but kind of sex hadn't really intruded in the Harry Potter universe. And that not... any of my fan fiction, I hasten to add. That was a big theme of a lot of fan fiction, of which I think kind of the typical thing of the genre, if you're being unfair about it, was, you know, Hermione had developed a lot over the summer. was the kind of a hardy perennial of the... Well, because it... Yeah, cause also,
no, I know. I think I wrote Harry Potter fan fiction once. I think it was slash fiction.
But there's also, though... A very interesting, if you now go back and look at the Harry Potter fan fiction that is excellent online, and as I say, there is, I think fanfiction.net, which is one of the biggest aggregators of it, has got nearly 1 million fics now. If you look at the because of the long summer that Stephen mentions, there is this kind of, there are a lot of very long running fics with 100 plus chapters that diverge from canon, from what Rowling wrote at the end of book 4, precisely just because of the publishing schedule. So there are long, very popular sort of branches that all come from that.
Can you give me an idea of some of the kind of tropes that you get? You know, like the way that there's in Sherlock, there's like Squidlock and stuff like, and John Locke. So, and that's shipping, which is putting relationships of John and Sherlock. What are the kind of classic? I know there's like a crazy bookload of all the like, what happens if you ship Neville with Luna, and then it becomes known as Moonpaw.
Harry Potter is big enough that there are almost sub fandoms within it, and one of the most interesting ones I think is the Marauders. So Harry's dad and his three best friends at Hogwarts, who all, you know, one of them was a werewolf, the other three became animagi. And there's a whole, like, subgenre of their adventures.
You just said the word animagi. I feel like a person who has found out that a lot of their colleagues are a lot more knowledgeable about Harry Potter than they had previously known. I feel bad because I feel like I thought I liked Harry Potter books a normal amount, and it turns out I've been very much paddling. I
mean, you may in fact like Harry Potter books a normal amount. It's just that many of your colleagues like them an abnormal amount.
But yeah, so there's like the Marauders are a subset. There's a whole like Draco Harry subset. Some of it not. Some of it just, you know, kind of joining hands across borders and like making friends and teaming up against the bad guys in improbable pairings. It's quite nice. There's a whole I went through a phase in my late teens where I was really, and actually more recently too, where I was really, really into like Hermione centric stories, and there's a whole branching off there. Like there's a whole subset of ones where Snape's not dead and she discovers him in hiding 10 years later and they team
Snape
up.
Dies. And then, spoiler alert.
And there is, of course, yeah, a genre I think we have to lift the veil over, which is the embarrassing character slash OAOC, author original character, which was always a shorthand for Harry Potter meets a girl like the author, Hermione meets a boy like the author. They were universally terrible. Because some of this stuff is actually quite good.
Mm. Oh,
you know,
yeah.
The thing that, you know, 50 Shades of Grey has massively dumbed down fan fiction
as a
genre.
Yeah.
But we forget that, you know, actually the Brontes started writing what we would now recognise as fan fiction. And, you know, there is a lot of, you know, very good young adult fiction out there, which, you know, the early drafts of which were fan fiction. And then, of course, there's 50 Shades of Grey.
No, I think that's one of the things that comes up. And there's a great book by Anne Jameson called Fic that explores a lot of this stuff and talks to people in the fan fiction community. And I think that that's one of the things that they feel quite... Well, two things. They get very antsy about people saying it's all about sex, isn't it? And then you go, well, no, it's not all, but there just seems to be quite a lot of sex. And then the other thing is the idea that it's all kind of crap. People sort of like exactly just doing sort of soppy relationships where Harry and Draco like hold hands and spend a lot of time cuddling each other. And actually some of the stuff that I've read, particularly with Sherlock fandom, is just fundamentally really good writing. And there's a point that Anne Jameson makes in that book, which is that things like, you know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, it's kind of, by Tom Stoppard play, is fan fiction. You know, there is a very established literary tradition of taking an existing work and writing something around it as a continuation, something that
our columnist Laurie Penny's made, is that the Sherlock BBC show that Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat make is itself Conan Doyle fan fiction.
Yeah, but it just tends to be when kind of, you know, men do it with the stamp of a literary authority, then it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a really interesting postmodern take on it. When, you know, teenage girls do it because we think that teenage girls are innately sort of silly and stupid, then it must be have no value or literary value to it. When as actually, and maybe Caroline, you know more about this, my impression is that most writers of fan fiction are 20 and 30 something women.
That's my sense. I'm not sure that there's any sort of accurate data on that, but just from what I've read and what I've seen, the conversations people have online, I think so, yeah.
Have you ever written any Harry Potter fanfiction?
I haven't, no. This is actually something I feel is a bit of a failure on my part, given how much time I've invested in the reading of books, the watching of films, and the reading of fanfiction, and the talking about this on the internet. I haven't, no.
And just to finish, I just want to ask you both a little bit about Pottermore, the online community. Are either of you Potterers? Is that what you call them?
I think, I have no idea. I have an account, but that's mostly so I can hate read J.K. Rowling's own fan fiction of her own work. Because this is something else we should talk about. So she wrote those 7 books and a couple of spin-offs, but she can't leave the universe alone. So every so often, like during the World Cup, Football World Cup last year, she released a little sort of vignette. 1500 word vignette on Pottermore that was Harry and his gang going to the Quidditch World Cup, and all done through the eyes of Rita Skeeter, and it was really bad and really infuriating, and I wish she would just stop writing her own fan fiction. Anyway, that's why I have an account on Pottermore, so that I can get upset about it.
Have you read any of J.K. Rowling's other non-Harry Potter fiction?
What do you mean, the
Cuckoo's Calling or The Casual Vacancy? Don't.
The Casual Vacancy.
I haven't read The Casual Vacancy. The Cuckoo's Calling, I was not a lover of.
I find most crime-related fiction kind of just sends me to bed and not in a good way.
Well, the guy had a false leg, and it was just one of those things that was a bit... There's a Wyndham Lewis novel in which every so often this guy, they describe the main character, and then it goes, he says of himself, "Of course I have a false leg," or like, "Of course I have a wooden leg." And there was a bit like it would be kind of occasionally like, Corbin Strike walked into the building quite slowly because he had a wooden leg. And it was just always slightly pathetic. But yeah.
Casual Vacancy is it's a very sad and angry book. Yeah, it's kind of it's sort of passable high-end trash lit, as it were. But yeah, it's very strange, partly because you still can't. It still feels a little bit like walking in on your parents. It's a very odd experience. I'm not a Pottermore. I have a very firm death of the author view on this. The books exist as the canon, and the rest of us can sort of spin off them.
But that doesn't make entire sense, because if you set the books as the canon, why wouldn't you accept later J.K. Rowling bits of output as the canon? Or is it just that you've decided your own canon?
I'm not making a claim for this being reasonable, or this is arbitrary, me saying that she is the author of these works is not allowed to subsequent. I'm just saying that. I wish she'd stopped before the epilogue at the end of book 7, to be honest, because that's kind of fan fiction too. Yeah, I think that I've decided, and actually a lot of other people on the internet have also shared this view, that is the Rowling canon, and... everything else.
That's like the end of Pygmalion and the end of the George Bernard Shaw play, where he sort of kind of ends the play and then he goes, "Well, this is what I think Eliza Doolittle would have done." And you're like, "No, well, you should have put it in the play then. Put it in the play." Well, I think that's we've all embarrassed ourselves sufficiently. So that's probably time to say goodbye and thank you to Caroline and Stephen.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich.
And if you enjoyed the New Statesman's Harry Potter podcast, we'd like to tell you about a new podcast that we're launching called Seriously.
It's the podcast from the New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
Every week, we're going to talk about films, books, music, fan fiction, internet culture, everything that we like and that we think you should like too.
And we're not ashamed to be enthusiastic and intelligent about the things that we love.
Even if, I don't know, people might say that they're not always the highest of brows.
You can find us at newstatesman.com/srsly.
And on Twitter as SeriouslyPod, that's SRSLYPOD.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.